And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Born during the despair of the Great Depression, tempered by the fires of the Second World War, on a parallel Earth very much like our own, yet slightly different, they're banded together the greatest forces for freedom ever assembled. Over the many ensuing years, new and younger members would join the veteran champions of the Golden Age, continuing their fight for truth, justice, and the American way. Becoming so much more than just heroes, they became legends. Back to the Bins proudly presents Legends of the Justice Society of America.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Legends of the Justice Society of America. This week, we're going to continue with the crossovers that we've been doing from Justice League of America. We're up to number 22. I am David A. Pascarella, and joined by my co-host, the producer of this program, Scott H. Gardner.
For a second, I thought you were going to introduce Paul, and I'm like, well, he's the producer, but not of this one. Yeah, so thank you for that. Yes.
I still think I get the producer title. You were the editor of this
one. Yes. There you go.
I was going to make you the executive.
You know what? I'll take executive producer because I see those credits a lot, and a lot of times I figure they don't really do anything. It's just, you know, an honorary title, so I'm kind of comfortable with that.
There you go. So welcome back. Do we have any news on the Justice Society?
Yes, they still started in the 1940s.
Couple things right out of the gate before we get going with the issue proper here. I know this is our fifth episode in, but as we sit to record this tonight, the very first episode is going to go up shortly. The very first episode is fully edited, fully produced, everything. It just has yet to go up. This is all old news to you guys listening to this, of course. But at the time, of course, that we recorded the episode and all that sort of thing, we didn't know what it would eventually end up sounding like. And I just want to give a huge shout out to our buddy Scott Rifen for being Mr. Voice for this particular show. He did our opener, which I think came out really, really well. I was very pleased with it and all. And I just wanted to say thanks to Scott for providing that opener. He did just a fantastic job with it, and I was really happy with how it all came out.
I totally agree. I think it sounds excellent, and I've considered calling him Scott the Voice Rifen.
Right. Yep.
Because as far as our productions go, he is the voice. I got to say, Gene comes close. He's got a really cool voice with stuff like that, but Scott is the, you know, he's the guy. And I want to put a shout out, you know, as we record this, we're not that far removed from episode 600, even though as you hear it, we're going to be far removed from it. But Gene and I have been talking this week, and man, did he do a great job with keeping track of the episodes and who's on them. And, you know, he sent me, you know, another copy of this, you know, or an updated copy of the spreadsheet. And kudos to Gene, because it's amazing how much information he's put in there. You can see what guest hosts were on, what episodes they were on, what episodes any given book was on. He's got it, you know, broken down where it's by the episode itself. Then he's got it broken down by the books. It's OCD at its absolute finest.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Yeah, that's something I always wanted to do and just never had the gumption to get off my ass and do. So I'm glad somebody did. But no, that's awesome.
And I said something to him about it. He says, yeah, sometimes I get these ideas and I just can't get rid of them until I put it into practice. He said, this time you are the beneficiary of that.
Couple other quick things. Just acknowledgement that our dear friend, our co-host, Dr. Bill, couldn't make it for this episode, and I was sorry that he couldn't. Also, last episode for Justice League of America number 21, you, sir, Mr. Paul Spataro, were not able to make the recording, And I know that you actually own that book, and I just wondered if you had anything to add to our discussion. I know you haven't heard the episode, you know, the recording or anything. Yeah. I assume you haven't.
I have not yet, and it's possible that there's things in there that were in my notes. And to be fair, or to be reasonable, I don't take notes as meticulously as you do. I kind of let the program bring me along, but I usually have a few notes. So just to look back quickly on issue number 21, first of all, I do own this. I only own it recently, as we've discussed on the show. And it's one of the books that, like, when I finally got a hold of it, that it feels like a bucket list item. Like, I'm really just happy to have it in my collection.
Right.
So, you know, that said, it's interesting to, you know, to review it. First of all, the cover is absolutely iconic. And I think that's probably echoed in your show, I would imagine. I can't imagine anybody not loving this cover. My notes were that I was a little surprised to see Batman as the chairman of the Justice League, because it kind of goes against his personality. Like, he's more of a loner, and to have him there as the leader seemed a little strange to me, although that's what they did in the DC cinematic universe, where he put the Justice League together all by his lonesome, which in and of itself should probably make you not like it as much. But again, I was just a little surprised by that. My other notes are that, you know, the criminals, the way they alerted the teams and in it to put set up a trap kind of seemed dumb on two levels. First, like, it seemed stupid that they would do that. And secondly, it seemed stupid that the heroes just said, okay, let's go and get captured. they mentioned a decade of inactivity for the Justice Society when they all get together. It almost looks like they're being woken up out of like being in suspended animation or something. Like, they're all stretching and, oh, it feels good to be back.
It's Buck Rogers.
But that puts them, in my mind, exactly where I want them to be. You know, as a sports fan, you know, sports athletes, rather, hit their prime usually somewhere between the ages of 28 and 31. Those are the prime years. So if they have a decade of inactivity, you got to put probably the Justice Society in their 40s, which is exactly where I want them to be. I want them to be older than the heroes, but I don't want them to be, you know, where they need to have a walker. You know,
that's a great point. And you kind of solved not a mystery, but just something that's been bugging me with this is, and I had the same issue way back when I was doing my read through of the Avengers. And you had guys like Hawkeye and I think Iron Man at one point, like, well, I guess it's time to retire. And I'm like, what are you, like 35? Why the hell are you? And, you know, it's because I never thought of them as basically athletes. And that's a great point that, yeah, they're, for what they do, they are kind of past their prime once they hit like 40-ish. So yeah, that's a really good point that I just never really thought of. I was thinking literal retirement, like, you know, when you're 65 and you retire type of thing. So yeah, and I'm like, oh no, they're way too young for that. So yeah, that makes more sense.
Too young to be retired from a desk job.
But it's like the police and the fire department, 20 and up.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good point, too. Or the military. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at most athletes, there's very few of them over 40.
Right.
I was a little, I don't know about disturbed, but it just didn't feel right that they're all getting nostalgic for their bad guys. Oh, we had those great fights. Oh, Icicle, yeah. You know, it just seemed kind of stupid.
Well, especially when the villains were lame, too.
Yeah. Dr. Alchemy with his Philosopher's Stone, I don't think that's how alchemy works, where you change something into physically another thing. I think you just change its chemical structure. You know, I don't think you can say, well, I'm going to take your arrows and turn them into twigs. I think you could turn them into wood, but I don't think you can turn them into twigs. Just my thought process.
That'll come up again this episode, trust me.
Wonder Woman's lasso doesn't work if she says the wrong name. Seemed a little dopey. And I absolutely loved the first shot where they show the two teams getting together at the end of the book.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Where, you know, the Golden Age Adam leaning down to shake hands with the, you know, Silver Age mini Adam. just some really cool shots. And those were effectively my notes for issue 21.
Okay. Dave, did you have any preamble before we jump into this?
I'll throw out a little bit of personal news on the Justice Society. Following your advice, Teresa and I started watching Stargirl. And we're up to about... Oh, it's fantastic. I think we're up to like episode 5 or 6. Now I got to go on sabbatical until she gets back from school because I can't watch it without her. But, man, it's fantastic.
Is it? What's it streaming on, HBO?
It's on HBO Max, yes.
I'm pretty sure
I think
sure
it's on something
have,
else, too.
I'm pretty sure there's a feature on there where you can sync. You could have, you know, I think it's called Viewing Party or something like that, where you could be in two different locations,
sync it,
watch it exactly the same time on both screens, and you could be like on a phone call. And you could, so this way you're watching it together, even though you're hundreds of miles apart.
Oh, good. I didn't know you could do that with that. I knew like Disney Plus you could do that, but that's good to know. So I guess we'll pick it up when she has time for me now. But it's great. I highly, highly recommend it.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind joining you guys for some of those, because the end of season two I thought was spectacular. And come to think of it, I still haven't watched the very last season, so I need to do that.
Yeah, actually. I have to watch the last season as well.
Yeah,
we should set up a viewing party. We should set up a viewing party and then record it.
Oh, that would be great.
That's not a bad idea. That could be arranged.
But I just found it to be a lot of fun and. The Easter eggs, tons and tons that you just, if you know the history of these characters, you go, oh my God, I know where they're going with this.
Well, you know, you had mentioned in episode 600, you know, being such a big fan of the JSA series. And, you know, in listening back to that episode, I noticed that I was like oddly silent. I don't know if I was like looking something up at the time or what, but I really should have backed you up more because I totally agreed with everything you said. I loved the original JSA. And like you, I felt like they lost something when they started it over again just to renumber and retitle it. But anyway, the one of the main guys, or maybe the main guy behind that, Jeff Johns, I mean, he was like the showrunner or whatever mm-hmm. for Stargirl. So that's why it does feel the way that it feels. And yeah, I thought they did a really good job with that. Very good job.
Yeah, I think I want to watch. I'm sure if you go on YouTube, they have something where they recap season one, because I think I want to watch that. And then watch the second season.
Yeah. Yeah. Season one was a little rough, I thought. I mean, it's good and it's enjoyable, but it's a little rough. But season two, I mean, to me, they were firing on all cylinders with that one, especially how it ends. Because it ends with like basically a jam. It's got everybody. I mean, everybody you'd want to see is there at the end. And it was awesome. It was really, really good.
And now that you say that, I think there were three seasons.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. So I did watch the first two. So I would watch the recap of the first two, and then the only one I didn't watch was the most recent one.
Now, like I've said, I've never seen this before. I'm going in, you know, cold, fresh. I do know that Stargirl apparently makes a cameo in that show Titans. I don't know if any of you have watched that.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. No, I do. Somebody, I forget. Somebody was trying, working me real hard, trying to get me to watch that. And I just had no interest. It just looked really bad to me. But yeah, I did not.
I started to watch it and I thought it was okay. And then it got a little bit, you know, it was a little over the top as far as its graphicness. And, you know, it almost seemed like it was doing things for the sake of, oh, look how edgy we can be, as opposed to for story purposes. I don't know if I would have gotten over that or not, and I may eventually try and revisit it, so I don't want to totally close the door, but that's the way it definitely started to feel to me.
Right. Yeah, I was kind of shocked to see Marv Wolfman seem like he was pretty cool with it. I don't know. I was going to say a fan. I don't know necessarily a fan, but... He did have a lot of good things to say on it on social media that I noticed. But then again, maybe he's getting a nice fat paycheck. I have no idea. But that, and they had Superboy, which I thought was kind of interesting. So, I mean, it was something I was keeping like half an eye on, but I just never pulled the trigger on actually watching the show.
So it's the Titans like from the 2000s, right, with Superboy.
I think
it becomes
kind of an
that.
Amalgamation of yeah. I think it
doesn't start
stuff
that. And,
yeah. But we should probably go ahead and jump into this because I'm not sure how long this one's going to go. So strap in, folks. Here we go. All right, so we are looking this time at Justice League of America, the original series, number 22. This is part two of a two-part story that we're looking at. Cover date on this one is September 1963, was on sale on the stands, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, on July 25th of 1963 for a cover price of a whole 12 cents. The cover credits on this one are penciler Mike Sikowski and inks by Murphy Anderson. And this is a pretty cool cover. I was looking at something that was saying that this is actually something of a recreation, homage, something to a cover that Anderson had done for another title, which I'm now suddenly blanking on, some like mystery title or space title or something like that. But it's a cool one. It's you've got both Green Lanterns. You've got the Hal Jordan Green Lantern and the Alan Scott Green Lantern. They're teaming up. They're in space, although space is all colored blue. And they're using their combined power rings to try to free their teammates, the combined Justice League and Justice Society. And they're all caged and everything on the cover. It's just really cool. And I love the cover copy. It's a sensational superstar spectacular featuring the Justice League and Justice Society Crisis on Earth 2. And you may remember that the first part of this was Crisis on Earth 1. So we're just kind of numbering up our crises here. The writer on this particular issue is Gardner F. Fox. Penciler is Mike Sikowski. And inker is Bernard Sachs, who I'm going to talk a little bit about later on in our notes section. I found some interesting things out about him. Again, story is Crisis on Earth 2. Roll call! Representing the Justice League of America, we have the Atom, whose headshot is miscolored, Aquaman, Batman, the Flash, Green Arrow, Green Lantern, John Jones, the Martian Mellow, Superman, and Wonder Woman. Representing the Justice Society of America, you've got the Atom, Black Canary, Dr. Fate, the Flash, Green Lantern, Hawkman, and the Hourman. And just because they bothered to throw it in there, I'll throw it in there too. You've also got a roll call for the Crime Champions, and they divided them between the Earths. So Crime Champions of Earth 1, you've got Kronos, Dr. Alchemy, and Felix Faust. And their Earth 2 accomplices are the Fiddler, Icicle, and the Wizard. So, synopsis on this. So I did write up a synopsis. However, I want to open with basically the recap from the actual issue. So the recap in the issue, the first page, which gives you the title and the roll call and everything, reads as follows. It says, as recounted in Crisis on Earth 1 in the previous issue, there is a second Earth, almost a duplicate of our own, which coexists with our world in different vibratory dimensions. And just as a group of superheroes has banded together to form the Justice League of America on our Earth, so has a similar team been formed on Earth 2, the Justice Society of America. Meeting in the borderland between the two Earths, the Crime Champions, a sextet of villains from both Earths, plot to commit a series of robberies and then hide out in perfect safety on each other's Earth, where they are unknown. However, as a precautionary measure, the Flashes of Earth 1 and 2, the only ones who might be able to identify the villains in their separate Earth havens, are quickly imprisoned inside its inescapable energy bubbles in the borderland between the two Earths. The criminal coup is successfully pulled off, despite the attempts of the Justice League of America and the Justice Society of America to stop it. In a follow-up battle, the Justice League members become trapped in their Earth-1 headquarters, how embarrassing, from which they are unable to escape because it is ringed with awesome magical powers. As a last desperate hope, they resort to a seance which materializes the Justice Society members inside the JLA headquarters. With the magical help of Dr. Fate, the Justice League of America is shifted to Earth-2 to resume its battle with its regular foes, while the Justice Society of America remains on Earth 1 to pursue the archvillains from its world. And that's a wonderful recap that I'm glad I didn't have to write myself, because it just works. It's perfect. Okay, so synopsis for this issue. So as the Green Lanterns continue their quest through the interspace between the realities of Earth 1 and 2 for their pals, the Flashes. On Earth 1, the Justice Society members set out to track down their villains who are running rampant on this alternate world. The Atom and Hourman find the Fiddler in the Clayville Natural History Museum, and the Mad Musician uses his instrument, which I always thought primarily just hypnotized people, to reanimate exhibits of a polar bear, gorilla, pterodactyl, and kangaroo. But Hourman is able to jam the Fiddler's frequency, and the two heroes take him down. Elsewhere, the Icicle proves no challenge for Dr. Fate, whilst elsewhere, Hawkman brains the wizard with a frickin' mace side the head, with a little help from the Black Canary. In the misty borderland between the Earths, the GLs face tough headwinds, but sense their destination in the distance. Chapter 2 sees the Earth 1 heroes tracking down their evildoers on Earth 2. The Martian Manhunter, Green Arrow, and the Atom face the magics of Felix Faust, but 3-1 is pretty good odds, and the bad guy is soon in custody. Meanwhile, Wonder Woman and Batman pursue Dr. Alchemy by air, and he uses his matter transformer to turn her invisible jet and his bat plane into winged bucking broncos. Let me say that again. Winged bucking broncos. That's really hard to say. So basically, he uses his matter transformer to turn airplanes into living winged horses, however the hell that works. And after a bit of sky rodeo, the heroes are bucked off and fall into a pit, which should probably kill Batman, by the way. Wonder Woman, however, exhibits a sudden knack for the Kryptonian ability of super tunneling, a Silver Age staple, and frees them. Together, she and Batman take down Alchemy with a pellet of powdered lead, which, as the Caped Crusader points out, everyone knows bursts into flame on contact with air. Except that, no, it totally really doesn't. But anyway, actually, I was thinking, since they're already borrowing Superman's goofier powers, why not have had Batman take Dr. Alchemy down by ripping the bat off his chest and throwing it, thus wrapping the villain in cellophane, since his emblem is already missing in the last panel of that page anyway. But there you go. In between worlds, the Green Lanterns finally locate the Flashes, but their power rings prove ineffective in freeing their friends. Back on Earth 2, Superman and Wait. Okay, I like these two as friends and like to see them teamed up occasionally, but since the JLA had an odd number of players to work with in forming two-man teams to begin with, why not let Superman go solo and team Atom up with somebody else, like, say, you know, somebody from Martian Manhunter's three-person team, thus giving you another team. After all, they did sort of the same thing with Dr. Fate. He went solo for the JSA, but anyway, besides the point. Superman and Aquaman go after Kronos, who still looks like he's doing a reverse Al Jolson whiteface thing, using a special vibration watch, whatever that is. Kronos puts Adam in a coma, which I've become convinced is a word that no comic book writer of this era ever actually bothered to look up, and tells Superman that the only way to save him is to expose him to kryptonite. Now, I don't know how the hell that works, but Superman, being Superman, never even stops to wonder about it, and instead whisks his buddy off to bathe in the rays of a green cave boulder, even at the risk of his own life. Aquaman quickly revives because, yeah, that's totally how comas work, and then drags his weakened teammate to safety. Superman uses his supervision to search for the escaped Kronos, but to no avail. It's Aquaman who figures out that the villain is traveling undersea and calls his fish friends to assist. Kronos is captured. Back with the Green Lanterns, they finally figure out how to free the Flashes by converting them to protons of light, whatever the hell that means. But the moment they are free, all 16 of our heroes, no matter which Earth they were on, fade away, victims of a prearranged trap that has just snapped shut. Chapter 3 finds the heroes of two Earths trapped, chewed to a cell in cages floating far out in the depths of outer space. Superman's mighty strength proves useless, as does our man's, and the Earth One Atom can't seem to shrink his way out. Suddenly, the Atom contacts the Green Lanterns caged together nearby through the telepathic communication system between the cages, because why wouldn't it have that feature, right? He says, I can't slip through the atoms of my cage. It was especially designed to prevent it. How he knows this? I don't know. But maybe you two can. And so the two Green Lanterns use their power rings to shrink to subatomic size. Because as we've already established, this is the issue for just nicking another superhero's powers when the plot needs them to. Thus, they are free. Soon, all 16 heroes are released, and it's payback time. Sensing a super ass-whooping approaching, the crime champions decide to make a run for it. But where to? Well, if there's an Earth 1 and an Earth 2, how's about Earth 3? So they decide to go there. It's a great idea, but it'll have to wait till issues 29 and 30 as the good guys arrive before the Fiddler can conjure up the power vibrations for the baddies to make the trip, and the aforementioned super ass whooping arrives. We saved not only Earth 1 and Earth 2, but for all we know, Earth 3 as well, says Dr. Fate. After the crime champions have been successfully securely jailed, Hawkman promises the JLA that the JSA will keep in touch, and the issue ends with Aquaman just having to remind everybody that Sucky Snapper Carr still lives. The end.
Whew. Do you need a drink after that?
Yes, I do. Anybody got this issue?
No.
No? Paul?
No, and my desire to have it is less after I reread it.
Oh.
But if I found it at a decent price, I would pick it up just out of the collector's mentality of completeness. The story has some stupid points, most of which you hit on already. But beyond that, I felt a serious drop in the art from the last issue to this issue.
Really?
And yeah, I think the anatomy in this one is awful. I'll start off by pointing you to the page where they're all standing over the fallen villains. Look at Superman. Look at his legs.
The very end of the book?
At the end of the book. Look at Dr. Fate. He's wearing a skirt.
Yeah, I did notice that his shorts look, he does look like it's a skirt, yeah, now that you say that.
But,
Superman, well, you know what? I'm going to defend the Superman one only because, and this is skipping way ahead in my notes, but Superman gave a really poor showing in this issue. I'm going to be bitching about that later on, but yeah, he deserves to be standing there kind of slumpy, but yeah, I don't know. Maybe as we go through and we're looking
turn,
at the,
turn,
the
go
panels,
to page. Go uh-huh. to page 10. Look at John Johns. Look at Superman. Tell me that they look good.
Yeah. Well, actually,
I think the anatomy is
terrible. Is this the one where Superman's pulling Aquaman?
Yeah, he's pulling Aquaman, and John Johns is carrying Green Arrow. Look at John Johns' right arm. What the hell is going on there?
He shaped it.
Did he had not yet met the what is it the who was it that made Mac a man? He's got a little wimpy arm there.
Charles Atlas.
Yeah. No, I don't care for the art in this issue.
The Superman, his feet look funny. He's got a Rob Liefeld thing going on there with the feet, but otherwise I kind of like that. I got to be honest. See, I thought the art took not like a quantum leap forward, but I did think the art was actually a little better in this one than the last one. So I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that, but by no means do I think it's great. I don't.
I mean, I took the art in the last issue as being, you know, your typical Silver Age-y art, and it wasn't great, but I thought it was, you know, it was all right. There were moments in it that I really enjoyed. In this, I don't think there's any panels in this where I thought that's superlative.
Right.
So, you know.
There's nothing you'd make into a poster is what you're
absolutely
saying.
Not. In the last one, when the two teams finally meet each other, that's a potential poster image. This one doesn't have any of that. This one, the attempted poster image, has Dr. Fate in a skirt and Superman having wimpy legs.
It's a skirt. It's not a skirt. It's a skirt.
You're right. It is a skirt. You're right. I'm just not fond of the art in this issue. Even when the Super S whooping goes down, it feels like it's a little, you know, feels like it's a coloring book.
Right.
Like it's just not doing it for me.
I will agree with you on that sequence. The Super ass whooping part just didn't artistically was it's weak. It is very weak. It is very color book. Just the way it's laid out is very coloring book. Yeah.
I found there was a pattern to the robberies that I thought was kind of odd. I mean, they're supposed to be, I guess, supervillains, right? The Fiddler and Faust are both robbing charity events. Fiddler's robbing a museum fund, and Faust is robbing a charity carnival. The Icicle and Cronus are both robbing things that are one of a kind, an artwork and a rare clock. The Wizard and Alchemy are the only ones with any sense, robbing a jewelry store and a bank. It just seemed like a weird... There was a pattern there for some reason, and I'm not sure what they were thinking.
Yeah, I totally didn't even catch that, but yeah, you're right.
I mean, if you're a supervillain, why are you wasting your time robbing a charity event?
Because you're a supervillain and you're mean.
And you're mean. That's the, you know, in the back of my head, that was the only thing I was thinking.
Do they parallel each other? Like, there's one of each doing that on each. Yeah, that's weird. That is weird.
Fiddler and
Faust. That implies that they're like the counterparts of the other ones, but they shouldn't really be. Yeah, that's weird. That is very strange.
You have to think it was intentional. And I just don't know why.
There was much more of the, like, what factor with this?
Oh, tons of it.
Yeah.
But a lot of my notes you hit on in your your synopsis, but you know the Wonder Woman with the, you know, being I was going to say human, but that's not actually accurate, but being a human drill, the Green Lantern shrinking, what the hell is all that about? We'll give them superpowers that we'll pretend never existed, you know, later on. And I kind of thought, like, the sequence with Superman and Aquaman, why didn't he just, like, kind of keep his distance and throw Aquaman closer to the kryptonite?
Well, how great would it be if that wasn't the cure and it was just to kill Superman? Bring him by this rock of kryptonite.
Yeah, they both would have died.
Yeah. And how much planning when, you know, they're on the opposite Earth, right? Why would they even suspect that he's going to run into Superman and Aquaman, that this plan would work?
Oh, Jesus. You know what? I didn't even think of that, because my note for this, and I was going to see, try to get your backup on this, Dave, because I'm already sick at this point of the kryptonite crutch thing. And that it's one of the things that kept me from reading Justice League on a regular basis, because I felt like they abused it even far more than Superman's titles did. And it just became annoying to me because, you know, I get it. You know, you don't want him to completely overshadow everybody else. I get that. But then having him run into kryptonite, like every single adventure, just gets really, really old.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking about that. But then I got to thinking, like, where the hell is all this kryptonite coming from? Because it makes it feel like, well, Krypton must have been as close as like the moon or Mars or something. But I got to thinking, didn't they? They did explain this, right? Like all this kryptonite came through like the same like space warp that Kal-El's ship came through or something like that.
That was later on. I mean, when we read something about this in another occasion,
right?
I kind of thought he sent it all back into space mostly.
Yeah,
there were a huge media headed towards Earth, and it hit, and the criminals got it.
Right. Yeah. So I'm confused because I never even stopped to think, wait, this is, it should be even rarer because this is not even his Earth. So yeah, that doesn't. But yeah, I was just bothered by, okay, I understand the need to not let Superman overpower, you know, overshadow everybody else on the team, but they went the completely opposite route because then he ends up looking like a chump. I mean, a total chump and kind of stupid too. But so I mean, yeah, I wasn't real happy with that.
You could have avoided Kryptonite altogether, as you have a magic-based character, and you could have used that as the force that weakens him.
Right.
Yeah. That's
instead,
true.
Nope. Yeah. Let's just throw a big rock at Kryptonite, and it was just stupid the way he gets suckered. It's not even suckered. He could have, like we said, chucked Aquaman onto the island, but nope.
Well, to me, it's just, I don't know. It's bothersome that, you know, so I'm looking right now at the ass whooping page, and specifically at the bottom of that page. I love that this is what we're referring to it as. But at the bottom of that page, you've got Alan Scott decking Dr. Alchemy with, you know, with a green fist from his ring, while at the same rate, Alchemy is shooting at Superman with his, I'm not sure if it's the Philosopher's Stone at this point, or if they just refer to it as a matter transformer, whatever this magic rock is. He's casting, I don't know, it looks like lightning or something at Superman, and it's bouncing off his chest. Now, granted, this is the conclusion of the book, and this is, you know, this is probably Superman's best showing in the whole thing. But what's to say whatever this thing is he's using couldn't hurt Superman? And that's where I feel like there's a lack of imagination here. It's like they're sticking so hard to the mandate of only Kryptonite and only magic can hurt him that you're limiting your character. What, you know, it would be nice for him to occasionally run into something completely unexpected that actually does knock him on his ass from time to time. That would keep him exciting and fresh and kind of belay that whole thing about, oh, he's boring because, you know, nothing hurts him and he's, you know, he's all powerful type of thing. So what if, you know, Alchemy accidentally did discover that, oh my gosh, my power actually hurts Superman, or you know, at the very least, you know, holds him at bay or something. You know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It is bothersome to me.
He could use a word balloon here that says it tickles.
Right. Right. Now, had either of you read this before?
I did. Me quite too. A while ago, but yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
If I had, I have no memory of having ever read it before. I would think that I should have read it at some point, but just had no memory of that whatsoever. I do have this issue, by the way. I got it. I'm looking here in my database. It says I got it on Halloween Day in 2022. Paid $23.43 for it. And yeah, after having read it, I'm a little bit regretful about that.
No, that's a fair price, though.
That is a fair price.
On the roll call at the beginning, the one that stood out to me was the Wizard, and for two things. First of all, what was the horror comic they had where it had the three people that were like the hosts of the book?
The Witching Hour?
I can't even think. I think it was like Cain and Abel. Or,
yeah, Cain and Abel.
Yeah. But he looks like he's one of them. But he also looks...
Oh, right, right. Yeah.
This really stood out to me. If you were making a movie back at the time when this came out, he could have easily been played based on that picture by Tony Randall.
And you couldn't take him seriously either then.
Actually, the Fiddler just above him kind of sort of looks like Khan from Wrath of Khan, like if he ever smiled in that movie.
He's happy Khan.
Yeah, did you notice that the Atom, the Earth One Atom, is completely miscolored at the top of the page? He almost looks like the Flash, but because that cowl is supposed to be all blue, isn't it? Or blue and red, I forget, but it's not all red. They've got it colored all red.
The copy I'm looking at has it in blue.
Me too.
Oh, so you must have a reprint. Let me see. I actually have... Now, come to think of it, I'm looking at a scan of it right now, but I do have the actual paper. Let me open it up real quick, and I can tell you, as originally published, it was red. Yep.
Wow, so a red item.
Yep. And then also on the cover, tell me if yours, I'd be very curious if yours is recolored for this as well. On the cover, the very last cage, the bottom cage with the green arrow in it,
mm-hmm.
it looks like that's the Golden Age Adam. But if you look real close, like if you zoom in, that's actually Dr. Fate. He's miscolored to look like the Golden Age Adam.
No, see, mine, it looks completely like the Adam with the symbol on his chest and everything.
Yeah, but that's not the Adam, though. That's Dr. Fate.
Oh, right. See, my note was that they made a mistake on the cover.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, because they miscolored Dr. Fate as the Golden Age Adam. So, yeah, they did. They screwed up.
Where is the, I guess Golden Age Adam wasn't meant to be on the cover.
Yeah, I guess. Who was he in the issue? Who was he caged with?
The other Adam.
Right, the two Adams that together.
Ah, okay. Oh, yeah, you're right. Yep, sure enough. Yeah, and see, he doesn't, you can tell it's not right because he doesn't have a full face mask here. This is where he's wearing the kind of Buck Rogers-y looking one with the fin on top, and it's a half mask.
Right.
But on the cover, it's a full blue face mask, like he used to wear back in the Golden Age. But yeah, it's not right.
Sloppy.
Yep.
Now, one thing I did notice in both of these issues, as far as the art goes, is from some of the positioning of the bodies, it's not nearly as good as what he would do. But just from the perspective that's put, and the Earth One Green Lantern would be an example of it, looks like it's from a similar perspective to what Gil Kane would draw.
I actually kind of thought it was Gil Kane. I kind of almost wonder if maybe Sikowski was kind of aping Kane. It's also possible that who was inking Kane? Is it possible that Anderson was inking Kane on Green Lantern at this time or something? Or had
very
come
well
off?
Could have been. Very yeah. well could have been.
Because I see a lot of Gil Kane influence on that cover. Like a lot of it. Or I'm sorry, not Gil, Murphy Anderson, rather. But yeah, it does lend kind of a Gil Kane look to it. And I kind of initially thought it was Gil Kane. All right, so page two, after the opener with little thing with the Green Lanterns, just kind of reminding us what they're doing, where they're off to. You've got the JSA is on Earth One, and they all split up. They're all going to three different places, three different cities to apprehend their bad guys. And they each one mentions the name of the city that they're going to. And I just thought the first one was really goofy because it's Hawkman. Yeah, Hawkman.
Alfalfa City.
Yeah, Alfalfa City. I'm like, really? Alfalfa City. So I looked it up. I thought, well, you know, stranger things have happened. Maybe there really is an Alfalfa City. Yeah, not that I could find. So yeah, it's made up. And from what I can tell.
Are we going to Alfalfa City?
Mr. Hawkman. It's obviously influenced by the Little Rascals.
Now, on this same page, that, you know, as I pointed out in my synopsis, this entire issue is plagued with characters exhibiting powers that I don't think they normally have. Now, I could be dead wrong about that, but I just want to know, you know, how does the Fiddler reanimate dead animals with his fiddle? Now, I always thought all his fiddle did was like hypnotize people. Maybe it does have other abilities that either I'm not aware of or I just don't remember. But no matter what, unless it's magic,
yeah,
how is he bringing a dead animal, a dead creature, and I presume a dead stuffed creature back to life?
That would be very cool. Like, it would be a very eerie power if he had it, but he doesn't have it. I thought, like you said, hypnotize, and that maybe he could even like project some sort of like a sound force bolt of some sort. But that was it.
Yeah, exactly. But related to sound, yeah.
See, I was saying to myself, it doesn't even look like he's reanimating them. It's like they're puppets that he's controlling because they're not behaving like animals would. They're grabbing them by their arms instead of biting the hell out of them.
Well, the only explanation we get is as our man and the Atom are being attacked initially by a polar bear and a gorilla, the little caption box just simply says, in response to that melodious summons. So it's implying that whatever music he's playing is bringing these, you know, making these things, but they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Dead things don't hear a melodious anything. They're dead. So I don't get it.
This would have been better done if it was like in their heads. That it was doing something.
Yes. If that was clearly, hypnosis to make them think that.
Right. There and then go. When they're defeated, they just disappear or they're back in the cages.
That's a much better. Yeah. I
see.
Yeah,
we could have written this.
You know what? They never say that it's not in their heads, so we could still read it that way.
Well, no, because he uses the pterodactyl to hit our man's radio, which I didn't know he had the ability to jam the fiddler's thing either.
Right.
All right, so it's not in their heads. It's just stupid.
And it's a new power for our man.
Well, did you feel as we see these villains very quickly defeated? Now, granted, they're facing their regular foes and everything, so maybe that's a partial explanation, but I just felt like based on the threat that they posed and the things that they were managed to do last issue in the part one of this, that they're taken down pretty handily right at the outset of this particular story. I found that a little odd.
Well, the fiddler's not, I don't find the fiddler particularly impressive here. I mean, if he was doing the same thing and the police burst in, they would have just shot him, and that would have been the end of the music, too.
Right. But, I mean, this is the same guy that managed to capture both of the flashes in that other story that we looked at. So it makes his power seem inconsistent.
Right.
You know, in one issue, he can, you know, put both of the, you know, the respective world's fastest men, you know, guys that can run virtually at the speed of light under his thrall. And here he can't handle a midget and a guy on, you know, that takes a magic pill to give him superpowers. It just, you know, it seems very inconsistent in that respect.
Well, it doesn't even seem that they need to use their gimmick powers to defeat him.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's a matter of they took him out with a radio.
That's a good point, because it never does it ever say whether our man took his pill? I don't think it specifically says that he did.
No, I don't think it does.
He was lucky that he had this radio, which I think he did have a radio in his belt buckle in the 40s when he used to call the Minutemen. But
Right.
But I don't particularly remember it being something that would jam signals or something. So,
yeah, that seems a pretty specific function.
I would think you would need to design something to do that.
Or at least adjust, you know, the waves and all that sort of thing. But I don't know. This issue already pushes me well beyond my suspension of disbelief for that sort of thing. So I can only give it so much leeway. What is this thing with Black Canary where she pulls like a, what is it? Is it like a miniature magnifying? Is that what she's doing? Like,
hang on one sec before we move on that far. Okay. I have one thing about the icicle's theft, how Dr. Fate stops him. So Dr. Fate has now destroyed all this artwork by causing a flood.
Oh, yeah.
We saved the village by burning it to the ground.
That is a really good point. Yeah, I hadn't thought. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Yeah,
also,
he does.
If he stole this artwork and he went back to Earth One and tried to fence it, would it be like, oh, look, I stole the Mona Lisa. Oh, but there's one hanging here in the museum. Is it worth anything on Earth One?
Yeah. Well, plus, I mean, you know, on Earth Two, the Mona Lisa may have a mustache or something. You don't know. I mean, it could be, you know, completely different.
Or it's like you go to Earth Two with the, you know, oh, it's a Da Vinci painting. And who the hell is he?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Or it's the Mona Betty on, you know, on Earth 2 or something.
And it looks like Betty Rubble.
You know, every time I watch the Flintstones, those always follow me all over the place.
That's all I've got on the Icicles, Robert.
The whole thing with Hawkman and Black Canary versus the Wizard annoyed me so much that I just basically breezed right over it in my synopsis, because if I spent any time on it at all, I would have something to say about basically every panel. It's just so ridiculous. But I did like the part where Hawkman, because I don't know, I'm forward projecting the Hawkman that I actually really like from that Palmiotti and Gray series. I like that, you know, to defeat the bad guy, basically Hawkman just brains him in the head with a mace, which should, it should just cave his skull in. I mean, look at that mace. It's all jagged and pointy.
Yeah, it's all barbed.
Yeah. And he just brains him with it. He should be dead. And actually, in the very next panel, he's laying there as if he is a corpse. I love that.
How come his wings didn't keep going into space?
Because he took them off.
And they don't work anymore once they're taken off. Okay.
That is the best explanation for it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look at when Hawkman is touching down on page, whatever the hell page this is, page 9, second panel, as he's touching, like, he is a tubby bastard.
He's doing a little ballet move there, too.
Yeah, he is.
Well, he's been out of action for 20
years.
He's
almost got jazz hands.
That's a good point, Dave. I'll give you the no prize on that. He has been out of operation for a while, so I guess he's put on some weight, but Jesus.
And, you know, there's a certain similarity in this to the Fiddler's thing, where he uses his device and brings in the Rockman.
Right.
And Black Canary's able to stop him by using an amulet to start a fire and distract him.
Hmm.
It's a little bit similar.
These people are pyromaniacs.
Similarly, the fight between Felix Faust and the three heroes, you had Martian Manhunter, Green Arrow, and the Atom. That equally annoyed me, because that was even goofier than the other one. He basically just puts him into like a super spin type of thing, which is, I don't know, it's just goofy. I didn't figure out how any of that worked.
I'm going to give them points for that, because they actually use teamwork to stop him.
Yeah, that's true. He ends up getting taken out by the Atom, which I would imagine has got to be incredibly embarrassing as a supervillain, especially somebody like Felix Faust. Taken out by a clout in the jaw by the Atom.
And you know, the story says he adjusts his weight to his normal weight of 180 pounds and then hits him in the face. Now, hit the average person in the face with 180 pounds worth of weight.
Yeah, it's going to tear their head off.
Right. Man. Felix is dead. So we've killed now two supervillains. I think they're doing a fantastic job.
All right, probably, and I mean, in an issue that is absolutely loaded with shit that made me crazy, probably the number one that just made me absolutely batty is on page 13. I need an answer to this question. How in the hell can Dr. Alchemy's matter transformer, if that's literally the function of it, is transforming matter, mm-hmm. How can it create living character, you know, living creatures from inanimate objects? How do you turn a plane into an actual horse?
And I'm going to make you even crazier. You ready? The plane, because when I read this, you know, I initially said, so did he transport their planes to Earth 2 as well? And then there's a line in here where you get that the planes weren't transported, but they were created by Dr. Fate. So they're not real planes even to begin with. It's a spell.
Oh, my God. I missed. Where is that? I missed that entirely.
Hang on.
Oh, yeah. Which Dr. Fate's magic has fashioned for. Oh, my God.
Right. So they're not even real planes. It's a spell created this, and yet he's able to hijack Dr. Fate's spell.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Paul.
I was going to say, I could just throw anything against the wall and you'll accept it logic.
Well, you know what? Go with me on this. So he creates basically Pegasuses, right? Mm-hmm. Pegasi, whatever the hell you would call two flying horses. He creates these flying horses, which essentially are magical beings, right? Magical creatures. So did he transpose one magical form into another?
That's a pretty rough no prize.
It is, but
I think you're being very creative. I give you credit for that. But all right, I still find it to be a little too much of a leap of logic.
I'll give you one better. Why didn't he just turn it into an Acme anvil?
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, turn it into a box, and they just plummet to their deaths. Yeah.
I mean, if I had no problem knocking people off, and I was good with that, that's what I would do, make it an Acme anvil.
And then when they're falling, after they get off the horses, Wonder Woman has a fat ass. I don't want to body shame her.
Yeah, she does, yeah. Well, you know, okay, so I am by absolutely no stretch of the imagination an expert of any kind on pre-crisis Wonder Woman,
but you are an expert on asses, right?
but I feel like I've read enough pre-crisis Wonder Woman to ask the question, considering her upbringing, or at least what I know of her upbringing, would a bucking Bronco really pose much of a challenge to Wonder Woman? She was raised on an island where they like rode, I presume, horses, but I know they had like giant kangaroos that they rode, mm-hmm. and they did stuff like that. They did stuff like, you know, athletic. I mean, that's how she became Wonder Woman, was in athletic competition with like riding animals and shit like that. So it's like, she's freaking Wonder Woman. A bucking horse presents a huge problem to where she can't stay on and she ends up falling off to her death. I don't think
she would have any problem.
None. Yeah,
it just didn't
ring true to me at all. It seemed really, really silly. And the super tunneling thing. Okay, this is Superman and Supergirl's thing. Does she really have this power? Because again, I know very little about pre-crisis, especially from this era of you know, pre-crisis Wonder Woman. But was she actually able to like human drill, like super tunnel, essentially? Because it just looks ridiculous. It's really, really silly. But this is a Superman and Supergirl thing, not a Wonder Woman thing, in my opinion. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't quite remember there being a tunneling power for one. Though she does do that spinning later on anyway.
Well, this is true, but yeah, she should be halfway through the rock and turn back into Diana Prince.
Now that would have been great, right? Oops.
Now that I am not 5 years old, when I read things in here that are present, you know, in old comics that are presented as stone cold facts, and I catch that they are complete and total bullshit, it really annoys me to the point where I want to sue somebody. So the whole thing with Batman being like, well, there was powdered lead in that pellet, and powdered lead, when it comes in contact with air, bursts into I'm like, what?
My entire childhood. I was afraid of pencils because I thought they might burst into flames because I read this stupid comic book.
Yeah, exactly. I got sent to detention because I wouldn't sharpen my pencil because I was afraid it would burst into flames in my hand. You know, yeah, exactly. I could see something like that happening to some poor kid back in this, you know, poor kid's traumatized.
Lead, phosphorus, it's very close.
I don't know. So the next page, page 16, look at the horrified look, in my opinion, on the Golden Age Flash's face as Hal Jordan is using a buzzsaw to try to open his bubble. If he was successful, he'd murder him. He just has this look like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah. Well, the Golden Age Green Lantern looks like he's putting a clip on to keep the chips fresh.
Got to keep it fresh in that bubble.
I know I already mentioned the Superman at the bottom, but doesn't it look like Kronos wouldn't have to worry about him because he's got a dislocated hip?
He is chunky. Wow. Yeah, he is. Yeah, he's tubby.
He's on his way to Social Security for that disability.
Well, I feel like I already beat the whole Kryptonian dead horse thing, so we can move on.
Yeah, we pretty much hit on that, and the whole just throw Aquaman over there, and so then, but then they capture Kronos and they put him in the Legion of Doom headquarters.
Yeah, I noticed that too. Well, I love, you know, the fish actually know like human geography terms, like. You know, they let Aquaman know that Kronos is moving towards the Straits of Magellan. They're fish. How do they know what the hell Straits or Magellan are? What they would have no concept.
They have an atlas.
I guess. You know, you forget the fact that fish go to school.
Ah. Oh, get out.
Oh, come on. I love a good dad joke.
No, get out. Top of page 18. First panel, the dialogue box, or the narration box says, deduced to protons of light by the power rings. I think they mean reduced.
Yeah,
my version says reduced.
Yeah. Okay. So they. Oh, okay. You must have a reprint that corrected some things.
Must be.
Did they correct any of the story?
You know, in fact, the art in this book is fantastic. I don't know what you're
looking at. Looks like Alex Ross like did it.
Alex Ross.
Okay, page 21, where the Atom, the Golden Age, oh, I'm sorry, excuse me, the Earth One Atom uses, the narration box just simply says, suddenly the Atom contacts the Green Lanterns through the telepathic communication system between the cages. Why would it have this feature?
All right, as long as we're going to have these cages for them, I feel like we need to put a telepathic system in for them as well. See, come on, supervillains, let's get together and do this.
I thought it was a new power created that the Atom didn't have, like this was his power to telepathically communicate. And I was like, I didn't know the Atom had that power. I didn't realize it was the cages.
Yeah, no, it's
you know, that is one way to interpret it, but even then it still doesn't make sense because it's not a power that he has. So, yeah. Okay, since when can Green Lantern shrink like this? Because I'm pretty sure that with this ability, you know, that this ability would have come in really handy in a number of stories with either one of these characters that I've read over the years. The ability to shrink to like escape a cage and stuff. So yeah,
I don't recall that being a power.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's there for plot convenience, and I hate that sort of thing. It that really makes me crazy when it's just it happens because the plot needs it to happen. We have our first mention of Earth 3. As I mentioned before, we're going to have to wait. Well, actually, we're not going to have to wait long on this show because our very next chapter in our go through of all this will feature Earth 3. But yeah, this is the first. We don't see any of it or anything. We don't know anything about it, but it is mentioned or at least speculated to exist for the first time.
I think that's a pretty cool foretelling.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know if when it was written, if they thought, yeah, we'll do this next, or if after doing this, they saw, you know what, that wasn't a bad idea. Why don't we go there?
Right.
But either way, it's cool.
Yeah, it might have been fan feedback or, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, that is, I thought that was pretty cool as well. On what page is this? Page 23. On the big ass whooping page, look at the Flash. Just look at the Golden Age Flash for a second. I love the look on his face because he's holding the wizard's wand, and just the position of it, the look, everything says to me, he's telling him, I am going to stick this where the sun don't shine. I love it.
That's the in-between scene that we didn't get.
Just kind of wrapping this up, I found this to be a much simpler story than part one, and I was kind of disappointed in that regard. There's a lot less logic applied. There's a lot more just silliness and leaps in logic and things like that. But more than anything, I felt like the challenge wasn't there. The threat and everything just wasn't quite there. I thought the first chapter of this, the prior issue, set everything up really nicely. And I really enjoyed the opener to this. So I was really looking forward to this chapter. But yeah, it kind of exists just to have everybody together and do things. But that's about it, you know?
Yeah. It almost has the feel, and this is an unfair comparison to what I'm going to compare it to. But if you remember when they did the Best of Both Worlds on Star Trek The Next Generation, after the fact, they talked about how they left them with a cliffhanger, and then they just said, yeah, we don't know how they're getting out of this, and we'll just leave it to the next writers to pick it up. And it almost feels like, and just to kind of finish that thought, there's been criticism of the resolution of that, which I didn't think was that bad, but a lot of people have criticized that, saying it didn't make sense or whatever. And I almost feel like this first issue set this up really well, and then they didn't know where to go with it. So it's like, come up with a resolution. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give everybody superpowers they didn't have before. Right. That's my resolution.
But I didn't really care. I'm not going to say I didn't care for it. One of the weaknesses, I think, was the uniqueness is bringing the teams together. And other than the two Green Lanterns working together, which is really very brief, and the two Flashes being locked up for the whole book,
and the ass-whooping page.
Right, there's no mixing of the teams.
Right.
You know, it's like you would kind of want to see, oh, look, a character from the JSA working with a Justice League character. Instead, it was basically, okay, your team goes your way, our team goes our way.
Yeah, that was actually in my notes. That was one of my disappointments, was that they didn't get to, you had that exciting moment at the end of the last issue where they all got together. And then you wanted to see that move forward in that way, and it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least not until we got to the super ass whooping.
Right. Well, what was it? Three pages tops?
But we don't really get interaction the way that you would want it, you know? I mean, this is historic. Just a page of art. Right. But I mean, this is an historic occasion. We got to see the two Flashes meet and get to know each other and interact for the very first time. And it was epic. It's considered, one of the seminal moments of DC Comics. Here's the two Green Lanterns meeting for the first time, and they basically just go on an adventure together. But there's no dialogue. There's no what's your deal, or anything like that. Plus, I was thinking about this today.
What's your deal? Wood. How about you? Exactly. Yellow.
I'd love a panel of each one of them thinking, it's like a shared thought bubble with each of them thinking lame, about the other one, something like that. But
this guy must be colorblind. Look at his suit.
The one good thing they did in that regard was that they took the Flashes off the page because they've already had their moment together. So you eliminate them from the equation, and now it gives you the opportunity to have these other people meet and compare and do everything, which they squandered.
Right. Well, for that matter, something I was thinking about today is so is Barry Allen the only comic book nerd on Earth One who even knows who these guys are? And if he is, on the team, on the Justice League, and if he is, then that begs the question, why aren't the Justice League treating him like, who are you guys? What you know, again, the whole question of, so what's your deal? And we never get that. They're just accepted right out of the gate. Like, oh, this is the classic guys. These are the old guys. And yeah, it's so wonderful to meet you and get to, and it's like, no, they shouldn't even know who the hell they are.
Unless you assume that after the adventures that we've already covered, Barry Allen in a Justice League meeting said, oh, I got to tell you something. I had this adventure where I went to this other plane of existence where there's another Earth and there's a Justice Society, not a Justice League. And he told them all about them.
Right.
You know, I would think that would make sense because
yeah,
wouldn't you want to tell them, hey, you know, I was reading these comics all these years and there's characters like us. They really do exist.
Right.
So I'm accepting it for that reason. I think it makes sense that he would have mentioned it already.
You know, you also have to think maybe Flash Comics was the only one published on Earth One.
That's a conversation that I want us to put a pin in and remember to revisit at some point, because something that I noted in this is notice that so far we've not had any doppelgangers. You know, we've not had any counterparts. So we haven't yet gotten to the point where there's an Earth One and an Earth Two Superman, Batman, right, Wonder Woman, and certain other characters. That will happen down the road. And so I want to examine in, you know, in conversation with you guys, how do we think that works? So
you're
talking about
doppelganger with the same identity,
right?
As opposed to two atoms or two Green Lanterns.
Yeah, but none of them share an identity. So even though we have two Flashes, two Green Lanterns, two atoms, they're all unique individuals that do not share a name or a power set or an origin story or anything like that. That's going to change once we introduce, at the very least, the big three, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. They all share an origin, a name, you know, a secret identity, and powers and all of that. If I was Superman or Batman, you know, in this world, you know, on Earth One, I'd be nervous as hell if I started learning that, oh, by the way, these comics that we read is, you know, this is real from this other universe, actually the other way around, you know, that Batman is thinking that, you know, on another world, his whole life story is being published and his identity is out there, type of thing. Knowing now that the villains can just flow freely between the two Earths, how easy would it be to learn his identity out of a comic book? You know,
I think what you're hitting on is the weakness of that particular concept.
Yes.
And then you're trying to put it into play for reality, which I think is, like you said, I think we can put a pin in that and it's worth doing. But I think ultimately it turns you into Yosemite Sam and your head's going to hurt.
Right. Yeah. Because I've already given far too much thought to this, but I'm trying to apply the logic to it. Like if that really is the scenario that Gardner Fox of Earth One dreamed of Earth Two and these adventures and then wrote the comics of and everything, why only the ones that didn't have, you know, an Earth One doppelganger with the exact, you know, why not Batman? Why not Superman? You know, why not Wonder, you know, and it just seems damn convenient. But it also seems like really fertile territory for somebody to have tackled that at some point to give an explanation to it. Like maybe there was a force behind it that was controlling it, or, you know, I don't know. It's just something I was thinking about today. But like I say, we can examine it again later when we actually meet some of these duplicates, because for all my knowledge, maybe there is an explanation down the road that I'm just not aware of, because I've not read all of these issues that we're going to cover before. So
I'm trying to remember now, in the original All-Star Comics, the first run.
Uh-huh.
I think it's only two issues where you have Superman and Batman appear.
Right.
I don't know if it's two or three, but it's definitely very limited.
Some minor things. So I mean,
yeah,
you could almost make it like Gardner Fox was picking up the vibes, and the only books published on Earth One were All-Star Comics and Flash Comics.
Well, it's also still though kind of convenient because it's not like there weren't plenty of Superman stories out there between Superman, Action Comics, and World's Finest. Right. So Superman of Earth 2 had plenty of adventures that could have been vibing over to Gardner Fox.
Well, it also gets into the whole thing of, okay, you know, going with that scenario that you know, DC Comics or whatever comics company was publishing The Flash on Earth 1 exists and is publishing something. They managed to survive all those tough years and the fade of the superhero and everything through all that time when eventually we got to a point where only Superman, Wonder Woman, and Batman were, you know, they were the only continuing superheroes of that line at one time. So, you know, it gets into a whole really weird area to me.
Because on Earth One, they were publishing Captain Marvel.
Yeah, there you go. I don't know. I find it fun to think about and speculate about, but
absolutely.
It's ultimately neither here nor there, I guess.
I find my last note on this.
It does make my head hurt, honestly. My last note for the issue here, beyond where this is all reprinted, is Bernard Sachs. I was trying to remember what I might know about him or whatever, just kind of refreshing myself on his body of work and everything like that. Because again, I honestly thought the art was a little bit of a step up. Not that it's great. I really wish that the interior was inked by Murphy Anderson like the covers were. But I did look up Bernard Sachs, and I found an interesting. I guess it ultimately comes down to an error on Mike's Amazing World website. So I looked up Bernard Sachs, and I'm looking at his body of work, and it's, you know, it's going right along and everything. And then there's like this huge gap starting, I forget exactly when, I want to say in the 70s or something like that. And then all of a sudden it shows two issues of some Star Wars title published last year in 2023. And I'm like, whoa, he came out of retirement to do Star Wars? But then I'm looking at like his first work was like in 1943. I'm like, the guy'd have to be like 100 years old. So I looked him up, and no, Bernard Sachs actually died in 1998. So I'm not sure where that error on Mike's website comes from. But that is clear. Those two issues of Star Wars are clearly not the same Bernard Sachs as inked this issue or whatever. But I looked to see who might be maintaining Mike's site right now and if there was any contact information. But the contact information has been removed from Mike's site. So whoever is maintaining it, if you just happen to be listening to this show, I just want to point that out. I'm not dogging Mike by any means. You know, that was a massive project that he did, and you know, it had to be just a bear to keep up with. But yeah, there is that error there. Just so whoever knows.
So before we end this, are we going to grade it, or what are we going to do?
Let's do some grades.
All right. F. You wanted more than one grade?
I'm not going to be as succinct as you are, but I'm not going to be dead horse.
I am not an F guy on this. I don't think the cover is bad. I really don't like the blue background. I don't think it looks good. I don't think the cages look all that great, but I still don't think the cover is bad. I think it's a solid B minus. You know, it could be better. But it still kind of, you know, gives us a lot of our heroes. It gives them, you know, gives us a glimpse into the story. I'm cool with it. So I'm going to say a B minus on the cover. I was very disappointed with the interior artwork. I think the anatomy is poor. I think the faces are poor. I think the kinetic motion of characters when they're throwing punches and stuff is also kind of weak. So I'm going to say just a C on the interior art. It's not terrible, but it's just not good. And the story is just batshit crazy, but it's fun. So I'm going to say a C plus on the story. And overall, I'm going to give the book a C plus.
I'm very close to you. I like the cover slightly.
I've often thought we were close.
I know. We bond.
We're just good friends.
I like the cover slightly better than you. And, you know, sharing the picture of the homage it's made of Mystery in Space. I don't mind the blue background. The only snag I had with it was the error in the box that should be Dr. Fate and Green Adam instead of
or Green Arrow, for that matter.
Green Arrow. Sorry, I got a bit of a frog now here at the end.
I'm the frog.
I graded the cover with a B+. I'm with you on the interior art. I didn't quite care for that as much. It wasn't terrible, but it wasn't fantastic. I gave it a C+, the interior art. I'm with you, and the story was, I think we beat it to death. I gave the story a C- for an overall grade of a C on the book.
I dig the cover, although I do have some issues with it. The biggest one is that the two Green Lanterns, the two most dominant characters on the cover, look cut and paste to me. They actually look like they're by different artists from different magazines that were cut out and stuck on this cover. So that's a little bit weird. But otherwise, I kind of like it. I kind of dig it. I don't think it's, you know, near as iconic as the prior issues cover or anything like that. But it's kind of cool. So would you say, Paul, a B-? I think B- is fair. I think that's a good grade for it. The Golden Age Green Lantern just, I don't know, his face and his head just look a little weird to me somehow. Interior art, I wish to God I could remember what grade I gave the prior issue that we covered. I don't remember, because all I would do is just bump it up just one grade. So if it was a C last time, I'd say this is a C+. That's it. I think it's just a hair better than last time. So whatever that grade was, bumping it up. So I'll say C+, because I honestly don't remember what my grade was last time. I just don't really care for Mike Sekowski at all. Everybody just looks like they need to go on a diet. Everybody's barrel-chested and quite often just tubby and weird, and the anatomy's all fluid and goofy. And yeah, it's not great. But I honestly did think it was just a tad of a step up from last time, for whatever that's worth. The story, unfortunately, was a big old step down from last time. And again, I don't remember what grades I applied to the story from the prior issue or what. But yeah, it just almost a completely different. It's almost like it's not even the same story. It's just so different. Because I felt like the setup was really good in the first chapter, and I felt it was just weak as hell in this one. It was just like they just wanted to get it over with. Like, let's just wrap this thing up. So everything was just, with the exception of the GLs, had a bit of a challenge, you know, finding the Flashes, freeing the Flashes. So their little chapter was, I wouldn't say exciting necessarily, but at least there was a little bit of something to it. But everything else was just very, very easy, very cut and paste. Oh, we need to go track down this bad guy. Oh, we got him already. And it's like, what? These guys were like badasses that were taking out both teams last time around, and now all of a sudden they're like total chumps. So yeah, just some of the goofier elements, Superman just being a complete dope. I mean, just willingly going to die, taking Kronos's, a villain's, word for it that, oh yeah, this is the cure, by the way, you know, stay in the area and die yourself. What? Yeah, it was really dumb. So anyway, not to just keep beating the same points over and over. Story-wise, ooh, yeah, I'm tempted with Paul's F. I'm gonna say a D-, because there was just too much stupid stuff, too much goofiness, too much just plot convenience, and more than anything, you know, just not enough spectacle to this. I mean, this is the first team up of these two iconic teams. And other than them solving the problem together, there's just not those moments that you would think. I mean, if this was written today, it'd be chock full of, you know, moments. And what I mean by moments is, I'm thinking of, like, you know, if you ever read, you know, the Justice League versus the Avengers, you know, the big team up that Paris, you know, there's those little moments, those little vignettes that we get of, you know, like Wonder Woman and Wonder Man arm wrestling and things like that, you know, and this should have something like that. You know, it's the first time the Green Lanterns are meeting. It's the first time the Atoms are meeting. I would like just one other character in the Justice League to be like, holy shit, I read about you guys when I was a kid. None of that. And it's just, I don't know. And so in that regard, it just kind of falls flat for me. It just wasn't near as much fun as the opening chapter. So overall grade on this one, I'm going to say, I'll say a B minus. And I think that's being very generous because it's really just slightly above average, honestly. And it's just for the coolness factor of all the characters that are in it. But beyond that, yeah, it was kind of a letdown, I have to be honest.
He's such a hater.
Sorry. I calls him like I sees him.
You're saying it needed Thor's hammer to be caught by Superman and thrown back at him, right?
Something.
That would have done it.
Unless you guys have anything else on this one, the only other thing I have is where you can find this issue reprinted.
And where is that, Scott?
So this issue, Justice League of America number 22, was reprinted. Whew. All right, hold on to your hats.
DC 100-page Super Spectacular number 6 in 1971, Greatest Team-Up Stories Ever Told hardcover and the trade paperback in 1990, Justice League of America Archives Volume 3 hardcover 1994, Crisis on Multiple Earths Volume 1 trade paperback 2002, DC 100-page Super Spectacular Replica Edition number 6 from 2004, Showcase Presents Justice League of America Volume 2 trade paperback 2007, Justice League of America Omnibus Volume 1 hardcover 2014, I have to track that down, that sounds interesting, Justice Society of America A Celebration of 75 Years hardcover 2015, Justice League of America The Silver Age Volume 3 trade paperback 2017, Crisis on Infinite Earths Box Set Hardcover, which I still need a copy of, 2020, and Crisis on Multiple Earths Crossing Over, a trade paperback from 2021.
Well, gentlemen, I think that's it for this time around. I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. Please give us some feedback. I really want to know what you think. How are we doing on this? How can we do it better? Next time, Justice League of America, number 29, and Crisis on the aforementioned Earth 3.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com. or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy, all rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks. And we'll see you next week.
That's all I got.
That's it.
Bye-bye.
That's the end.
You're still here? Go home. It's over.